KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
806-949 KUOW. A word or two before we get to Speakers Forum. We're able to go out around Seattle and record these interesting talks and present them to you largely because of listener financial support. It's the biggest single factor in our budget. We like presenting these for you. If you count on hearing Speakers Forum each Thursday evening, then please step forward and make a pledge of support. The spring pledge drive is online for the evening now, so it's quick and easy to go online and make that pledge in whatever amount suits your budget. But please, if you're in a habit of regularly listening, please pledge at KUOW.org. Thank you.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Can we all become more competitive? Journalists Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman say that yes, we can. In their new book, Top Dog, they use science to analyze the drive to win in each of us, including how to tip the scales in our favor. They spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on March 5th, 2013.
Normally, Ashley gets to talk first, since this is my hometown. I'm going to go first tonight, and we're going to trade off and spar with each other a little bit. I'll just be clear that we co-author our books. We're not competitive with each other. I'm not
mostly.
Just... What's
mostly.
That?
Mostly.
I'm not just saying that. I think that we have two different competitive styles that complement each other. We are very competitive, but we team up against all the other journalists out there. And nothing gets our blood boiling more than seeing someone else like misreport some of the science that we've been studying for years. And that drives us like on a day-to-day basis. Our publisher has us staying at the old Olympic, the Fairmont. And I was excited to wake up this morning and see the Seattle Times, and right there on the headline, Top Dogs. And I'm like, oh my gosh, we made the cover of the Seattle Times. And then I flip the fold, and it's about the Gonzaga Bulldogs being number one. And I was like, oh yeah. Thought my hometown paper was coming through there. But... So there's a lot of sports in this book. In each chapter, while we're writing about politics or military science or education science, there's often a companion piece where you're seeing the same pattern played out in sports. And I didn't really know like what to think about it. I love sports. I love sports. My family in San Francisco, we watch way too much sports. Growing up here in Seattle, we played too much sports, we watched too much sports, or in theory, like I couldn't justify how much of our lives was revolved around sports. And I struggled with it, and I struggled whether all my life, whether it was a meaningless distraction to occupy my mind away from other more productive or useful purposes of my time, or was it really adding up to something? And then Ashley and I started, we've been writing about the Olympics, and we were writing about ancient Greece. And ancient Greece is known for two things primarily, the Olympics, the ancient Olympics, and democracy. Now, I might have already prompted something in your head, like you might be thinking that. But before you walked in here, did any of you, do you normally think about the connection between the Olympics and democracy, or which came first? You think about that in any way? It's kind of an interesting story. So the Olympics were actually a religious festival. And the temples of Zeus and Hera were there outside Athens. And people came. There was a truce. Every 4 years there was a truce. And people came from throughout Asia Minor to worship there. And they usually had like different kings, whoever was the most powerful person there, lighting the Olympic torch. And today we have the Olympic torch going around the world with a relay as a way of lighting it, sort of unify the world. But back then, they started to realize who's the most important king here? who should light this flame. And they decided to come up with a 200-yard foot race. They decided that would be fair. Each nation or state would put up a runner, and the fastest would get to light the flame. And that was the very first Olympic event in 776 BC. And they began to add other events with the idea that this would be through fairness that a winner would be decided. And what was important is that in ancient Greece, power was bestowed through birth, like in all societies prior to that time. And the notion that it would be based on a race or based on sort of fitness was a very different idea. And in that truce time, people came from all over, and the athletes trained for a month. They didn't just come and compete. They trained for a month to get better. And thousands of people congregated to watch these events. And as they watched soldiers from lower castes train their bodies to surpass people of higher castes, they started to wonder, if you do this with your body, can you also do this with your mind? And because there was this truce going on during these times, there were orators in the public squares and philosophers talking about Pan-Hellenic union and can we have this kind of truce more often? Can we have more peace? And they debated ideas and they argued and for literally like 200 years. That every 4 years, the Olympics became not just a sporting event, but a form of political discussion about what Greece should be. And 200 years after the original Olympics was the first voting in Athens for the origins of democracy. And I thought that was really interesting. From mere sports, from a mere foot race, and what that was about led to this foundation of a society that we have today. That democracy is a competition where we cooperate. We agree on the rules of democracy, and then we compete for let the best ideas win.
So thinking of, you know, where little competitions represent bigger ideas, that's something that we were doing throughout writing the book. And one that I found almost as surprising as the Olympics actually being the catalyst for democracy, although I found that pretty surprising. It was hard to top that one. But, you know, there's been an idea that's very popular that, you know, collaboration is the answer, right? Who here has heard collaboration is the answer? And if we want a little more tech bent, who here has heard open source collaboration and crowdsourcing is the answer? Well, I heard that. And, of course, if you've ever heard of open source, what you've heard of is Linux. Linux is proof that open source works, right? The people who raise their hand, you're nodding with me? Okay. So Linux is this operating system for computers that was started by this guy, Linus Torvald, who was still a computer grad student, and he had this idea, and he kind of just put it out there on a listserv and said, hey, anybody got any ideas on how to improve this little thing I've been doing? And it's now 15 million lines of code, and developers around the world have been working on it. And Linus has never written a check to anyone saying, thank you for working on my software and helping me, but it's being used on Android phones. 7 out of 10 financial transactions have computer servers that have a Linux component in them. So the story of Linux, the story of open source, is if we give people the opportunity and ask them for ideas, they'll come forward. And it's pretty altruistic, and look at the amazing results you can get. Right? I mean, it's kind of like, who wants to be a millionaire, the old one? I'm stuck. Well, let's just ask the audience. Who here has an answer? And everyone in the audience will tell you what the answer is. But it's kind of weird, you know, all of these conversations in terms of how you developed code, they're all out there. It's part of the open source process. Torvald doesn't say that the development of Linux was all people holding hands singing Kumbaya. In an email where some programmers were complaining that one person's code had been used and not the others, Torvald's response was, life's a game, and if you're not in it to win, what are you doing here? One coder is not collaborating with another on Linux. They're competing with each other on whose code's the best. It's not an altruistic, hold your hands, everybody just does this for fun endeavor. The Linux Foundation says that 75% of the development of the code has been done by people who are paid to do it. They're not people from the Linux Foundation itself, but of the most recent Linux list of the top 20 developers, Microsoft was on the list of top 20 developers. Hundreds of companies pay people to develop Linux and approve the product because they use it in their phones, in their computer software themselves. It's to their advantage to do this. So once I sort of had this new concept that open source was actually everyone is welcome to participate, but really only the best are going to stick around. 60% of Linux is developed by 10 guys. Most people do one patch and they're never seen again. But there's a few people who do 3,000, 4,000. And they're the ones whose fingerprints are really on it. And when I thought about this, again, I was like, well, okay, there's definitely a competitive element in here. But I had always been told not just that collaboration was the answer, but the competition is the anathema to creativity. And that actually, just like when we started looking back at the Olympics, made me think, well, who are the great masters? You know, who are the people who changed what I think of as art? And I have a Bachelor of Fine Arts, so immediately my brain went to Renaissance. And it turned out what we know of modern, what we know of really any Western art, all came directly from competition. Da Vinci would sit in public squares, much like this, and they would have a paragone. And the paragone in Renaissance Italy was when Da Vinci would sit here against someone else, and he would argue why fine art was more important and a better art than poetry. And then he would go and he would have his students in their lab paint paintings side by side, and he'd go around and say, yours is better than yours. And he told his students that competition would fuel them because if nothing else, it would shame them that their compatriot was doing better than they were. And it would spur them to work harder and harder and to use that competition as a motivator. And he himself, and it wasn't like he said, but I'm a, you know, I'm a master, I'm a famous artist, I'm not above that. Once Da Vinci was hired to do a mural in a palace in Florence, of a scene of a war. And he accepted. So had another artist who was going to paint a mural on the opposite wall. Same war. That upstart guy, Michelangelo. Da Vinci loved the idea of having a public battle. And there's some versions of the story that the Duke actually came in and said, we're only keeping one of them. We only keep the one that's good. Michelangelo flipped out, couldn't take it, he left. But Da Vinci stayed and finished his painting. And it's not that Michelangelo thought this competition was, you know, inappropriate. His agent, he had one, had a contract for him for the Pietà. And the Pietà contract said that Michelangelo's sculpture would be the best work of marble ever done in the history of Rome. There was already this little thing called the Colosseum and, you know, the Forum. But if Michelangelo's Pietà didn't top it all, he didn't have to be paid. Can I, if you imagine if you were in a contract where you said your work, unless it was the best ever in history, didn't have to be paid? How would that go over? I'm sure your bosses would love it, but I don't think you guys would be going for it. So that competition isn't about hurting creativity, it's about fueling it and concretizing it in a mission and in a point. Most of modern conveniences that touch your lives every day are out of competitions. I want you to think about that the next time you get a can of corn or green beans or a bottle of ketchup from your pantry. The reason you did that is because Napoleon wanted to feed his troops, and produce was spoiling on the way to the battlegrounds. So he had a competition. And the competition was, how do I feed my troops? And the winner is led to the technology for bottling and canning food. And that was so successful, Napoleon III had a competition on how to get butter to the troops, and that's why you have margarine.
Ashley Merriman and Poe Bronson, authors of Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. They spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on March 5th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of the talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
KUOW. Later this evening, the survival story of an Episcopal minister who somehow walked through one life-threatening illness after another, and whose many challenges deepened his appreciation for life and for the suffering of others. Listen for that tonight at 10:30 on Humankind. Lows near 50 tonight, breezy and rain. Friday, highs 50s to lower 60s, breezy, rain at times. Speakers Forum comes to you through listener support. That's the most important factor that enables us to bring you these talks. Please get in on the action during our spring pledge drive by going online right now and making a pledge of support. Listener support is important. I've said that so many times, but it's worth repeating. Make that pledge if you haven't yet. If your membership has lapsed, that's fine too. Just renew it. Go online and make that pledge that automatically sets your membership back up. Listener support provides great radio like Speakers Forum, like Humankind, like As It Happens, The Diane Rehm Show, Morning Edition, All Things Considered, Prairie Home Companion. The list is long and the list is high quality thanks to listener support in largest part. Please pledge now at KUOW.org. Thanks.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. We must be more competitive in order to succeed. That's the statement drilled into our minds since we were kids. But how exactly do we do this? Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman are the authors of the book Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. They use science to explore victory and defeat, the psychology of rankings, and the neuroscience of mistakes. They spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on March 5th, 2013. Bronson speaks first.
So, you know, I'm spellbound listening to you. I should just join the audience here. But so I think one of the things we're saying is that collaboration and competition are not opposites. And I think that the most obvious version of that is that most of us these days do things in teams, especially in our work, or in our volunteer projects, or our families have to work as a team somewhat. And
We're a team.
We collaborate in order to compete with those other journalists out there. And you have to collaborate and compete at the same time. You have to collaborate really well in order to compete. And it's an artificial construct that they're separate. So, you know, when talking about teams, one of my favorites is a guy we got to know through this book was Jason Lezak, the American swimmer. And Jason became famous at the 2008 Beijing Olympics in the water cube. He was the anchor man for the American 4x100 freestyle relay team. And that race, that gold medal had been America's for 13 straight Olympics up until 2000. And we lost it in 2000, we lost it in 2004. And we won it that day in Beijing. It was one of the real highlights of that Olympics. Lezak, his fastest time he had ever swum the 100-meter freestyle was 47.67 seconds. And that day as the anchorman, he swam it in 46.06 seconds, which was a full second faster than the world record at the time. And it was the equivalent, like in the sports blogs that broke out, as equivalent of a mom lifting a car to save her infant from underneath the car. Like, how could this possibly have happened? How could he do this? And what was so interesting about Jason was that he actually does that reliably. For 10 years as the American anchorman, he swims faster for a team or for his country than he does for himself. He can't by himself accomplish the same thing he can do when he swims for a team. And he was always doing that, which is why he was the anchorman and why he bonded that team together. That is the promise of working on a team. That's what we always want teams to be. The problem is they're often not like that. You know, in our workplace, 90% of workers are actually on multiple teams. So rather than like swimming for America, that's like swimming for America and Russia and China and the product team and the quality team all at the same time. And by sort of these having these reduced allegiances, we undermine that potential great power of teamwork. Teams are also enormously complicated just to do all the logistics to coordinate team members. When you have a team of six people, there's 15 interpersonal relationships on that team of six. 15 different lines of communication going on. When you add just two people to a team, it goes from 15 connections to 28 connections. A lot more logistically to do, which is why they, sort of the people who study the science of teams say that, they note that 62% of software projects are delivered late, 49% are over budget, and that coordinating a team is a 40% loss in productivity from individual productivity if you're working alone. So teams have to make up for that. And so the question is, how do you make up for that? How do you make up for that loss of all that coordination? What they say is the most, we tell a story of what the CIA has learned from building anti-terrorist spy teams. We also tell some stories from Dallas Hospital about role clarification. And to me, this was surprising because growing up, I had this idealized notion of teams where a team, on a team, the best, perfect team is we're all equal. And we're all equally have a voice and we're almost interchangeable in roles. And the science says that's totally wrong. It doesn't work. And the best thing that you can do on a team is to have clearly defined roles, a clear hierarchy, and you need to know who does what on a team to make it work really well together. So going back to sports, which I love, they look at NBA pay disparity. They look at teams that have equal, more equal pay versus ones that have unequal pay. And having unequal pay tends to be about six more wins a year.
Well, and the romance of teams, I think, builds on the sort of equality is everyone needs to be a team, good team player, right? We're all good team players, right. And then we all get along. And that's key for good outcomes. That's why you have to do those weekend retreats where you fall backwards. Has anybody besides me seen the YouTube video of the little girl doing the trust thing and someone standing behind her and said, but no one told her to fall directionally, so she fell forward. Poor little thing, but I was busting up laughing. Well, some of you already chuckled. Let's talk about team player. I don't think anybody really knows what that means, but the scientists don't. I asked them. I'm like, where is the scientific scale on good team player? I'm like, that's not a science thing. We don't know what that is. But we have this impression of it, right? And it turns out that the impression we have that everybody needs to get along, that it's an equal group, well, just put that in a job advertisement that drops the quality of every applicant who goes for that job. Because Kobe Bryant doesn't want to be a team player, just like all the rest of the boys. He wants to be Kobe, and he wants you to know it. And he wants the shoe contracts to go with it. And that doesn't hurt team performance. That's what Poe was saying in terms of the NBA hierarchy. Stars can lead a team to do really well. And the rookie who barely made it onto the team is okay if he's playing around Kobe. Because he can learn from that. He can be inspired from it. And this isn't something that's in sports. Star physicists lead to more productive students. But the other thing that, you know, I think that those weekend retreats are trying to convince you about everybody getting along so well, that's another one of those myths, the romance of teams. And my favorite example of this is research by Richard Hackman, a professor at Harvard University. And he went around the world studying the world's best symphony orchestras. And what he found was the better the orchestra sounded on stage, the more discord and argument was going on offstage. When I read this, I busted up laughing out loud too, because my dad was actually president of San Diego Symphony when I was growing up. And all my life I heard, oh my God, the violinists hate the new first chair and the tuba players are flipping out over the blah, blah, blah. And there was just this enormous arguments going on. And what it turns out is we're going back to the stars want to shine. You know, violinists have been training to be the next Midori, the celebrity who's going to go on solo tours their whole life. And now they're auditioning for the biggest symphony orchestra they can. They're proving they're one of the best musicians in the country. And what's the reward they get for this? They get to dress in exactly the same outfit as everyone else. They get to have their arm movements exactly the same as everyone else. And if they do their job really well, no one will ever be able to pick out their musicianship from anyone else's. Can you see why this might drive people who spent their whole lives being stars crazy? It turns out that team relationships don't drive team performance. Team performance drives teams' relationships. If you're doing badly on a project, if you're late, if your boss isn't happy with the product, you start taking it out on your team. If you're doing really well, and everyone says, gosh, that was great, what do? Well, you know, we just got along so well. In lab studies, people have said, we got along so well once they were complimented for being so successful, even though they'd been arguing the entire time. We've got to see that those personality exchanges are actually a good thing. It's not even expressions of just mere frustration like in the orchestras, but those arguments are actually the ability to feel you can bring out a new idea. The teams that only have team harmony, that's because everyone's focused on protecting the relationship and not actually saying what they think needs to be done. And the better teams are the ones that do have some occasional conflict because it is an actual exchange of ideas. It's not a personal attack. It's just focused on what the purpose of the team is and then moving forward from that.
So I want to kind of bring back some of the domain that we touched on in Nurture Shock and go back into kids. You know, I think it's very important to know that when we talk about teaching kids competitive skills, one of the crucial things you need to make sure that they learn how to do is not just to turn it up when challenged, but when to turn it off and when to learn to select where your energy should be put and to not have to feel like you have to compete at everything and when to recognize when it's not helping you to sort of be competitive. And that's like a really crucial competitive skill. And, you know, I know writing a book about science of competition, we're also talking about the healthiness stuff, is to turn it off when it's appropriate. And the thing that's really brought this out for me was the research on elite schools. And this thread of research first came from Caribou Jackson, who was studying kids in Trinidad and Tobago. But then it was replicated with other research coming out of China. In China, in the college dorms, you don't change dorm mates year to year. You stay with the same dorm mates for 4 years. And they also found this in a study of 5 million British kids. And then most shockingly, it was replicated in studies of kids who get to go or don't get to go to their dream charter schools in the American South. And all of these studies were saying that in elite hothouse competitive schools, girls, by going there, do great. Almost all girls do better for getting into the most resource-rich environment where being around other kids who are high performers helps them move along with the crowd. They compare themselves somewhat and they move, have this sort of constant trajectory upward. But the science was saying something different, and it's quite shocking to me, about boys' performance in these schools. The science was saying that many boys would actually do better to not be in such a competitive environment. That all the resources of these schools are great for them, but the feeling of being compared and how they rank is something they can't turn off as well. And if you're on top in that environment, it's great, constant trajectory upwards. But if you're not on top in that kind of environment, the sense of being behind will always eat at these kids. So they were showing that kids in the American South who entered the lottery but did not get to go to their dream charter school had a higher chance of going to college than the boys who did get into their dream charter school. It's shocking. In China, that research, they show that the top-performing girl is a shining light on her dorm mates, but that the top-performing boy suppresses his peers. In Britain, they show that the top 5% or boys tend to suppress the performance of the other boys around them. This was shocking to me. I grew up here. I went to Lakeside School, which is an elite competitive school. I remember, I don't know, is Jay Edmark here by chance? So Jay's mom, Jay didn't do so well in school. And I remember freshman year, and he was always hanging around me, and I was over at his house, and his mom took me aside and said, "Thanks for being Jay's friend. I'm asking him to spend a lot of time with you. I'm hoping you'll rub off on him." And now I know that that was probably like the worst thing, like to pair up an A student with a D student. Like, it wasn't working. We tell the story in the book from the Air Force Academy, and we tell the story of the 2011 graduating class, which they did not know it, but they were part of this huge experiment done by some economists. And they had, as entering freshmen, they had tried to reduce, it's an extremely elite school, it's ranked extremely highly, you have to be nominated by a U.S. congressperson just to get in. But even then, it's incredibly competitive, and some people have to quit or flunk out every year. And they tried to engineer squadrons so that people who might or were likely to be low performers were put in squadrons with a bunch of high performers, with the idea that, like Jay Edmark and myself, the high performers are supposed to rub off on the low performers. And it backfired. More of them dropped out or were flunking out than less. And it was because the low performers were paired up with people who every day, day in, day out, it was when they went to study at the library, in class, when they went to drill, out on the sports field, they felt like they couldn't compete. And the lesson is not pull your kid out of an elite school. That's not what I'm trying to say. What I'm trying to say is it's important to teach kids to turn off this relentless sense of comparing themselves all the time to other people around them.
You mentioned boys. Let's talk about boys and girls. A lifetime ago, I actually worked in the Clinton administration. And at the time, I had my shiny little certificate, presidential appointee. It's pretty cool. And one of my bosses, a woman, considered herself to be sort of a mentor to me. And one of the first things she did was she gave me a stack of leadership books to read to help me on further my political career. And I started reading them, and they were all talking about how women's leadership was not to be leaders, which I thought was a little weird. And I kept reading further, and it was, you know, women's strength's really about coalition building. And women really aren't that competitive. Well, I'm pretty competitive, and that was driving me crazy. And the research was sort of giving me the same reaction as when I started this book. I did not want to hear that women were not competitive because I didn't believe it in my own life. I didn't believe it in anybody I knew who were in politics or law school or in school, just generally as I grew up. And both of us just really didn't want to discuss research that we felt the goal was to say, well, you know, women really can't compete. They're about coalition building and everyone getting along. And you know what I think about teams all getting along. But then I found the research of Sarah Fulton, and she changed the game for me entirely. Sarah is a researcher, a political science researcher at Texas A&M, and she surveyed 835 sitting state legislators. So they've already been elected into office. They're already political, willing to compete on the highest, most public stage you can imagine. And Sarah asked them a couple questions. One was, are you planning on running for Congress, that next step up in the next election? And she also said, if you did run, what's the likelihood you'd win? And what she found was that the ambitious men responded, yeah, I'm gonna run. And it didn't matter if they actually thought they'd win or not. Just wasn't a factor. But the women only said they were going to run if, yes, they thought they were going to win. They needed at least a 20% chance before really anybody started saying yes. And the higher the likelihood they were thought they were going to win, the more likely it is they were going to run. And the guys still didn't just change anything. Now, that's important because if you think about it, you know, 2010 was considered a catastrophic year for congressional incumbents. You heard that, right? Oh, just booted the bums out, didn't we? Yeah. Normally, they win 90 to 95% of the time. In 2010, that terrible year, we only reelected 87% of the incumbents. So you can see, the guys were saying, yeah, but I believe in these issues. It's time to challenge them. I don't know if I'm going to win, but I'm going to put my name on the ballot. And the women said, I do not waste time with losing. Thanks, no matter. And that changed my understanding of competition, especially when you're talking about women and competition. It's not that they're competing less hard. Once they've committed, they're in. Just as hard as any guy, maybe even harder, according to some of the studies. But they refuse to waste time in losing. The line is really, are they willing to compete in the first place? And they're looking really hard at those odds. Women, it turns out, are really good at figuring out the odds, and men are really good at ignoring them.
Ashley Merriman and Poe Bronson, authors of Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. They spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on March 5th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of the talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
KUOW. Lows near 50 tonight, breezy and rain. Friday highs 50s to lower 60s, breezy, rain at times. Looking ahead to Friday night, lows mid to upper 40s and rain. And Saturday highs lower to mid 50s, showers and a chance of afternoon thunderstorms. Latino, no it isn't. We'll hear a program of storytelling recorded live on stage, starting in a few minutes. A geneticist and Nobel laureate learns the truth about his origins. A 9-alarm blaze in Boston's Chinatown teaches a daughter about her father's wisdom. A cop tells of his misadventures during a stakeout. And a man is plagued during a road trip with dreams of what might have been. All next hour, beginning right after the 9 o'clock news. If you make a habit of listening in the evening, why not pledge now at our website, kuow.org. The Spring Pledge Drive is going strong, thanks to folks just like you who have gone ahead and made that pledge in an amount that suits their budget and their listening habits. kuow.org is the place to go to make that pledge. Please do so now. kuow.org. Thank you.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman are journalists and the authors of Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. They spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on March 5th, 2013. Next, they take questions from the audience.
Well, I'm retired now, but I practice law. And I know that I was unprepared for the competitiveness of law. It was very hard for me to learn male behavior so I could compete. And I just wondered if you had studied law because there are more women in law school now today, but women still are underrepresented in the senior partner ranks. I mean, a lot just drop out, and it may be that they find balancing work and family too hard, but I wondered if the competitive nature, I think most people still regard the practice of law as very male, a very male culture, very competitive, hierarchical. And I just wondered if you'd studied that and if you have any information about women in these types of competitive situations.
Well, luckily we have a lawyer right here.
I have the anecdotal experience, and we've read actually a lot of research relating to legal fields, politics, and obviously, what you were describing reminds me a lot of my experience as a litigator, which was, if you can't make the associates cry, it's just been a bad day. And it's better to make the associates on the other side cry, but if we got to make your own associates cry, that's okay too. Obviously, I think there are work-life balance issues, and I think that those, especially if you're talking about the partner track, then those factor into the woman's calculation of, is this a winning proposition? If I stay here how long, and I could get partner, but I don't know if I could get partner, but I know I will miss the soccer game, or I will miss my kid's birthday party, or I'll be staying late, is that worth the calculation? And that's a separate conversation than, say, what's going on right now with Marissa Mayer and Yahoo, and should you be in the office? The work-life balance choices are, I think, again, it's part of that cost-benefit analysis. I also think that there are indications that women's communication styles are different. There's lots of research about that. Women, even successful women, basically don't want to have a conversation about their achievements unless the person they know they speak to is already equally or more accomplished than they are. So they're very carefully gauging how they're playing in these conversations, and they're not going to necessarily take a risk that they think they can there's a chance they can lose. So yeah, I think that that's going to push them in other conversations. And I've noticed, just looking at the employment reports, the rise in contract attorneys, right? So people who are not in the contract, in the partner track, but those who want to keep practicing law, those seem to be a lot of women because they're making that choice. I can have a sure thing with a work-life balance versus the unknown of the partner track.
So this question is similar to the differences between men and women in competition. I've worked for 3 years, almost 35 years in the corporate world. And one of the companies I work for, the last one I've been in for 15 years, when I first got there, every echelon that had power was women, all the way up to the top. And I'm not a great observer, but after 13 years, you start to pick things up. When women were in charge, it was very collaborative. They would ask all the way down to the bottom level, what do you think of this decision? And do you think we're doing the right thing here? About 7 years ago, it switched over to where it's mostly men all the way up the hierarchy. And now pretty much decisions are handed down to us. Here's what we're doing. Here's when we want it done. If you have a problem with it, please let me know. I find it quintessential male and female differences. But what it strikes me as is that it may be cultural. Maybe this is British. Maybe this is French. Maybe this is European ways of men and women. This is how they figured out how to compete. And I'm wondering, in your research for your book, did you go to Asian countries besides a swimming team, or, you know, other cultures, Russian culture, who knows, might be
right,
different.
So the science of competition is worldwide, and a lot of the studies come from all over the world. It wasn't quite what we were looking at, but to kind of to the context we're talking about, how do we culturize or socialize these habits into people from the earliest part of their lives? Ash and I will both talk here for a second about amazing work. One of the most interesting things we ever heard was from Joyce Benenson out of Harvard and Emmanuel College in Boston. And what she looks at is the natural playing style in preschool years up through kindergarten of pair-based play and the natural playing style of group-based play. So stay with me here because this is actually going to connect back to what happens as adults. But in group-based play, and it happens to be the case that, you know, when they're 2 and 3 years old, left to their own, boys will spend two-thirds their time in group-based play and only one-third in pair-based play, while girls is the opposite ratio. And by the age of 5 and 6, that has increased. Boys are spending, at that point, like 76-78% of their time in group-based play, and girls only 16% of their time. But what do they learn when you're in a group, and what do you learn when you're in a pair? When you're in a group, often there's a reason that you're together as a group. There's something that brings you together. We all like Power Rangers or Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles or something, or trucks. But even within, because that bonds you together in this group, you now can actually individuate in that group. You can actually be a little different than the other people in the group. Because the groups, there's a lot of people, you have to be loud to be heard. You have to learn to be self-assertive and even to sort of be aggressive somewhat. Groups play a lot of games, and in those games there's a lot of winning and losing, but you keep staying back together. In groups, there can be conflict because there's natural mediators there to butt in and help out. And in all these ways, group-based play gives kids who spend their time in groups these kind of precursors to competitive style later in their life. And then you want to talk about pair-based play?
Well, a pair, which is usually what girls are in, is, oh my gosh, are you my very best new friend? You are? I knew you were. Do you like pepperoni pizza? No? Apparently he's not my new best friend. Debbie, do you like pepperoni pizza? She's my real friend. Are we all the same? We like everything the same, don't we? We do, I know. Pair-based is about finding the commonalities to the exclusion of differences. And over time, what you learn is that to compete means to risk losing your very, very bestest friend. Don't want to do that. So that actually may be the precursor to that accuracy and risk assessment. Because if you're going to compete and lose your best friend, you better at least win. Just to add the cross-cultural component a little bit. So this is an evolutionary biology thing, and there seems to be definitely some evo-bio stuff going on. Benenson has had 6-month-old infants look at pictures, and boys are more interested in pictures of groups. Girls don't care. There are obviously, though, cultural differences on top of this. So researchers have looked and compared Sweden to Israel. And in some points,
The girls doing a race just don't want to compete, and the boys are all over it. And in other countries, the boys and girls are running just as hard. They went to a couple Aboriginal countries. They went to the Maasai tribe in a Maasai culture in India and the Yosa in Africa, and one of them is traditionally matriarchal and one is traditionally patriarchal. And they found that in a patriarchal society, the men were competitive and not so much with the women. In the matriarchal, the women were more competitive. So then British researchers said, well, what if we did like a fake difference? So they went to single-sex middle schools in the UK and co-ed middle schools. And they found that in the co-ed middle school, the boys were more competitive. And in the single-sex schools, the most competitive girls were more competitive than the most competitive boys in the co-ed school. So it seemed like giving them the opportunity to have this natural instinct makes a difference. But then you go, well, then should all the kids be in single-sex schools, or at least the girls? But the research on that actually says probably not, because the sex differences don't get removed from a single-sex school. You know, the idea is like, well, if we put all of the girls in a school, they'll take math and science because they won't be worried about those boys. Single-sex girls get girlier in single-sex schools. They take less math and science. And boys get more boyish, more rough and tumble, more interested in sports, more interested in group activities, less interested in academics. So the cultural and the evolutionary biology things are going on at the same time. The scariest and most fascinating hardwire study I've found in terms of the whole nature-nurture is, I think you've all heard of like when the scientists give boys, baby dolls, and the boys use them as trucks, right? And you give girls trucks and they play with it like it's a baby. Researchers gave those toys to capuchin monkeys, and the boy capuchin monkeys were taking the baby dolls and just slamming them into the ground, and the girl capuchin monkeys were taking the trucks and going like this. So there was obviously no nurture element going on. It was just that they wanted, in their very play, it to be an intimate, bonded relationship.
Okay, but there can be nurture going on. So that might be something we work with. Like, with our daughter's soccer team, when we read this work and I went home to talk to my wife about it, we were out, then I had practice that night for the girls, and we were talking about it, and then that weekend's game, we were like, we realized they're taking turns with the other team. Like, we kick it, now you kick it. We kick it, now you kick it. Girls, and at practice that night that I'd split them up into the blue team at the end of practice and the orange team with, colored pennies on, and I just did it, and I noticed right there in front of me, there's 5-6 girls on the orange team, and they paired up on the orange team. Like, you're my partner on the orange team. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is happening right in front of me. And they were taking turns on the weekend, and I started yelling, like, stop taking turns with the team. And then at halftime, my wife lit them up one and said, it's always your turn. It's not their turn. Keep taking your turn. And they won the game. And that's like now the mantra on our team. It's never their turn. Don't give them a turn. And that's like the philosophy of our girls' soccer team.
Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman, authors of Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. They spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on March 5th, 2013. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of the talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.